It may just end up being you and me, Sam, and we'll carry the show. But we need to get something out there, so.
Yeah. So what? How about that big news, huh?
Oh wow.
I'm recording now, by the way. So
yeah. You are okay.
Yeah.
Are you talking about the first edition release? Pretty much, a lot.
Yeah, any of it. We haven't recorded an episode since that, so.
Well, that's true. I think the release of the first edition books is a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a nice nod to the old school community, and a great, you know, I'll probably buy them just because they'll look good on the bookshelf, you know?
Yeah.
And it's a nice nod, and I think I actually gave, all except my Monster Manual, I think I gave my first edition books away to one of my kids, so I don't have them really anymore. And so...
Yeah. Oh, see, I have like two sets of everything.
I've seen pictures of your...
Yeah. Some of them...
Your library, and I am insanely jealous, but yeah, that's...
It is truly a library.
It's massive. It
Carol,
is. I mean,
Carol often tells me, "Oh, we don't have room for anything else. We're gonna have to sell some of your books."
and you just like dagger eyes. It's
exactly.
Woman, what are you trying to do? It's like don't even go there. Yeah.
Yeah, but I'll still if I can scrape up the cash, I'll still buy them because it's a nice. If nothing else, it's a really nice gesture. For a company that gets so maligned about, you know, customer service and not caring about their fan base to some extent,
right.
You know, depending on whose complaints you listen to this week, that's a really nice gesture to put, even if it's only 1% of the profit that goes to the Gygax Memorial Fund, it's still a nice, it's a nice little bonus, you know?
Yeah, it is. And I can't believe, of course, the internet being the internet, you know, I can't believe there are people that were actually complaining that they were doing that.
Well,
and it's,
you know,
and it's like
it's the internet.
You just do a face palm and you go like, "Guys, really?" And these are people our age, Sam. That's what I don't get. And it's like, have you no wisdom? Have you not? Are you still living with your mom? You know.
Yeah.
I'm not sure
what
the deal
mean.
Is, but it's just. And now I'm sure we'll get hate mail for me saying that, but I just, you know. Have some respect, and you know it's a company, and they're doing a thing. So just chill out. So
I don't know. I mean, you know, it's really funny because you know I'm sort of cynical, and I kind of said the other day, well, you know, they're going to playtest D&D next, and it's probably going to be in playtest for like 2 or 3 years because, or maybe forever because you know. You know, the virtual table, how long has it been in playtest and in beta, quote unquote beta. You know, if you just never want to release a final product and you want to hold back certain things, you just say it's always in beta. But that's really just cynical, you know. I mean, I find it really funny that that WotC is getting some flack for the playtest part because the goal is to try to make a game that everybody will like or that will bring people together and unify people. The goal people think is unattainable, so therefore it's laughable. So then they get crap for doing an open playtest and taking open feedback, but yet Paizo gets lauded for the same thing. So, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah, the popular expression is haters are gonna hate, so...
Yeah.
But I think the thing that... Did you see what they put out today about how they're going to sort of tighten down on some of the rhetoric? Especially in their forums and stuff.
I'll be completely honest with you, and I will say that the only conversations I've had about D&D Next have been with people, not on any internet forum. I recorded the episode of the Tome Show with Tracy and Jeff, where we talked about it right after the announcement, and I talked about it with a friend of mine in person yesterday. And I'm talking with you about it right now, but I have not said a word about it on Twitter. I haven't posted anything on my favorite RPG site, which is RPG Geek, which I'm in every other conversation over there, right? But
right.
I'm not talking about the next D&D. It needs to calm down, and we need to start seeing stuff come out that's really what they're doing and really what they're designing, and then I'll start, you know, talking about it. But
having
right now,
it's just
conjecture,
thing.
You know.
Yeah.
I mean, look at, you know, people are arguing about, you know, whether, you know, what was the big topic yesterday, whether you know, whether about classes and races and
et cetera. Yeah. I actually have a blog post coming out Thursday about that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's important stuff, but I'm not currently part of the playtest, so I have not seen any. I signed up. Hint, hint, Watsy, if you're listening. I signed up. But, you know, I mean, I haven't seen anything. So, you know, and I don't know. I'm sort of just holding my tongue and I'm not saying anything because I don't feel like I have anything really important to say right now because I'm not making a comment about anything.
Right.
You know, lots of people have already said things that I agree with and they've stated things that I agree with. So I know those things are out there and I know that Wizards is listening. So I don't feel the need to make a big deal out of saying, you know, I want that too because, you know.
No,
already,
I agree.
It's already been said. So
I think I agree with you. I'm enjoying some of the conversations. I watch more of them than I participate in.
Mm-hmm.
And when I am doing a series of articles. It's not a formal series, but as ideas come to my head, I'm sort of throwing some ideas. It's like, well, you know, if we're playing a new game, this is what I'd like to be seeing, you know, that those kinds of things. And, of course, I'm on This Is My Game now, so that's where all that's coming out at.
Yeah.
But what they did today... And I don't know. Let me see if it's on their site on the front where I don't have to dig for it. Let's see.
Is it a rule of three or is it the Legends and Lore column?
No, it was
It's a special posting.
I think it was in the forum stuff because what it basically
the community forum.
Yeah, because I think basically what it said was that it was regarding the Edition Wars,
mm-hmm.
and they basically came out officially and said, look. You know, we're not going to participate in Edition Wars. We want your feedback, but it can be done in a respectful way. And they gave a bunch of examples on, you know, instead of saying, you know, they would say this, say this kind of thing, but not this.
Right.
And it was basically, don't just say 4E sucks or don't say this edition mm-hmm. sucks. Say, this edition didn't do things for me that I'd like it to do.
Right.
You know, in other words, and they gave examples. It was like a half a dozen things or more. And it was great because it was like, you know, now you can read this and say, look, you know, there's a way to be, there's a pattern to being respectful.
Mm-hmm.
And people are still going to break it anyway, but at least they can then ban those people that are just deliberately being trolls.
Or they're basically putting the word out that, look, if you express your opinion this way, in other words, if you're going to come on here and be a total douchebag, we're probably going to, since the beginning of your post is completely offensive, we're not going to read the rest of it. So whatever your idea is, it might be the best thing since sliced bread, and your opinion is perfectly valid, but we're not reading it because you're being a dickhead.
Right. So, yeah, it's – I wish I could find
– Don't worry about it. It's
– Yeah, okay. You know. I was going to link it
it's
in,
out
but
there.
I don't see it. So
I try to stay away from the WotC forums just for that reason.
Yeah, and I probably would have found links in my, because several people retweeted it. Oh, wait, that's how I can get it.
Yeah,
so. I know I retweeted it. But yeah, it's been kind of it's been a big couple of weeks. You know, there's been lots of news, so.
What other news? What's the other news that you're thinking about?
What else? Of course, DDXP is going on.
Right. Yeah.
That's coming up. That's a big deal. A lot of people. I would love to be able to get to the point where I could go to that and Gen Con. But I guess coming up in, 2013, DDXP is going to be a part of Gen Con?
Right. Yeah.
How does that work? Are they merging the cons?
I think they're just going to, you know, focus on. They're going to say, look, you know, Gen Con is a very important convention and it's the top one in gaming and it has the most membership or whatever, the most. Sells the most tickets and all that, and it's less specialized, so it has the opportunity to reach a wider audience. So they might as well just, you know, rent one of the hotels for all of the D&D events, you know.
Okay.
You know, rent a portion and just say, you know, these are the DDXP events, right? And in other words, this is WotC at Gen Con, but now we're just going to say these are the DDXP events, and it's synonymous with WotC at Gen Con. And
oh,
go,
okay.
Right?
So yeah, that makes sense.
They're not going to have two conventions where they have some stuff at Gen Con and some stuff at DDXP. They're just going to say WotC, when it goes to Gen Con, that's the same as – they're going to do everything that they would have done at DDXP and more.
Right.
So.
And that makes sense on several levels.
Yeah,
so.
It does. It absolutely does. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, I would love. You're saying you'd love to get to go to both. I would love to just make it to one of them.
Yeah, I know, man.
But yeah, it was a tough year for me, but that's hopefully going to change pretty quick.
That's good.
Relatively quickly. So you know, we'll see. I have to get a job, and you know, the problem with Gen Con, and it's the same problem that lots of people in education have, is depending on where you're at and what the academic cycle is.
Right.
Gen Con happens to fall either right when I need to be starting work for the academic year, or right before that when you're doing a lot of prep, and it's just the wrong time.
Yeah, this Anna will actually have to take a week off. They actually start school the week before,
mm-hmm.
and she'll actually of course she's a she's an admin. She's not an actual teacher.
Yeah,
but so she can actually afford to do that. But it's with it being a variable time, which I think is weird. I think they should just have it at one particular week during the year. I don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, I know that Chris Hurd from the Icosahedrophilia podcast, he has the same issue because he teaches at a university, and I have sort of my same issue is that, you know, we just that's a really critical time for us, and it's just not possible to leave at that time. So
yeah, it makes it tough to do. I think ultimately, whether it's, I mean, even if it's not DDXP, I'd like to try to ultimately make a con in the summer and a con in the winter, you know, whether that's PAX, one of the PAXes or something, or PAX East, I guess, because PAX West, I guess, is in August.
Yeah.
Or PAX, the original one.
PAX
so,
Prime.
PAX Prime, that's, yeah, the appropriate name. But yeah, that's...
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to go to several conventions. I think it would be a good, a nice, fun thing to do to sort of complement my hobby gaming. But, you know, it's not a necessity, per se.
Right.
And I know that because I have been unable to make most cons most of my life, so.
It's kind of a new thing. Well, and throughout my life, I haven't been, I mean, last year's was only my second and a half Gen Con. So, you know, I've not been a lot myself. Never been to Origins, never been to any others. I've been to a couple local cons, and I do intend to start going to CantCon, which is in Kansas City, because that's literally just an hour away.
Right.
So, I'll probably hit that up, but that's a small con. They're growing, but it's a small con.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll probably be that and Gen Con will be the extent of my convention going activities.
Yeah. Oh, trust me. If I got a job in Indianapolis, I would be at Gen Con every year.
Oh, yeah.
You know. And if I get a job where there's a local con, I'll probably go to the local con. But I'm not. It's not, you know.
Sam, I believe you secretly get the job outside of Tulsa.
Yeah, that would be cool.
That way you can actually come up and game this. That would be awesome.
So we'll see. I mean, I'm keeping my fingers crossed. And
yeah, you got your feelers out. That's all you can do, man. So,
but anyway, so edition wars and how we can prevent them. So what else? What else is going on?
There's a lot of like I said, there's a lot of talk regarding aspects of the game. You know, it's hard with the news only what a week old, a week 2 weeks mm-hmm. old.
Yeah.
You know, Twitter is filled a lot with, you know, the minutia of the game. It's my feeling that they've probably got a pretty good solid skeleton already. Or they wouldn't have released any kind of playtesting. Otherwise, what are you going to playtest, right?
Right. Well, the whole group of the friends and family that went to the fake organized play conference that was actually a playtest, right? I understand why they did that. I'm not making fun of them. I'm just saying, like, that's what they told everybody, right?
They did do some organized play stuff. But
they did. But they also sort of got a sneak peek at
absolutely.
And sort of playtested
the
next iteration. So, you know, they already have, you know, this was my conclusion, was based on that, they already have some sort of foundational document. And it may be the most bare bones of bare bones, but it still exists. And it's still, you know, they're still figuring out how to lay the groundwork for everything that they want to do.
Right. I mean, I've got suspicions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like you, I'm sort of hesitant saying them in a public forum. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I mean, I'm not part of the playtest, so no one sent me an email yet. So, you know.
Hint, Foxy, if you're listening.
But I don't know. I could see them going like a Gamma World route mm-hmm. as far as player, you know, as far as character creation. You know, you have a blank set of races, and then you have a blank set of classes. You put two and two together, and boom, that's what your thing is. Without all the it's a little less messy that way. And that's a wild guess. I mean, shoot, I could be way off, but
one of the things that people liked about Gamma World was you got to establish your own weapon, right? Like you basically had a weapon category, mm-hmm. and then you got to actually say what that was.
Right.
And describe the narrative around the use of that particular weapon. And it was still able to be mechanically different from someone else's weapon mm-hmm. if needed, but it could also be mechanically the same, but yet a completely different weapon.
Right.
I know that's something that a lot of people liked because it seemed like it offered a lot of freedom.
Right. I think it did. And I could see, you know, because what they're saying is that, you know, theoretically you could sit down and someone who's used to playing first edition could sit down next to someone used to playing fourth edition and they could all get along, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that works because for someone who's in the newer frame of mind, just the general weapon class works great, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I am using a one-handed 1d8 weapon.
Right.
You know? And without any kind of any more detail on that. Whereas the first edition guy says, I'm using a one-handed 1d8 weapon. It's a longsword.
mm-hmm.
You know? And so it fills both categories. It fills both needs of each one, but it's done in a, you know, in either a more granular way or a less granular way, depending upon what end of the spectrum you're on, I guess, best way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a guess too. I mean, I don't know, but
that's
the kind of thing I would think that we would see if they want to truly be able to have, you know, bring these different groups together. You know, I think there's going to be a modular aspect to it.
Mm-hmm.
But
I think so. Let me interrupt you for a second. Was that a long dog shaking in the background? Is that what that was?
That was a long dog actually who had been buried under covers and then tried to jump off the couch, and the covers went with her.
Nice, nice.
So everything sort of just fell off the couch at once.
That's a gracefully acrobatic long dog.
Yeah. She used to be more like a cat. she would jump up onto the back of the couch, on the back of chairs. And she would sit on them like that, or lay down on them like that, and just like a cat. But she has, since she hurt her back, and she's over that injury.
Mm-hmm.
But she has learned lessons, and she's older now, and so she's not quite as spry as she used to be. So
yeah. Anyway, so sorry for that digression.
Yeah, it's okay. You heard the long dog.
You know, there's a lot of there's some discussion, and you know, they. Both Merles and Cook have said things like, well, we want everybody to be able to sit down at the table and play D&D or whatever, regardless of what edition they favor or what style they favor. But, you know, I think it's really vague to say that. And the reason I say that it's really vague to say that is because, you know, first of all, people who all play 4th edition don't even sit down and play the same way. I mean, it's just part of the tradition of D&D to make your own game,
sure.
And people have different styles, and you like different types of games, whatever. So part of me is like, you know, they say that, and I understand, I think, what they mean, but, you know, it just – it opens the door for people to come in and say, oh, you know, that's impossible.
Right.
And on the other hand, I also think to myself, well – How is it possible? Because do they really mean that the 3.5 and the 3.0 and the second edition and the first edition player and the fourth edition player are all going to sit down at the same table? You know, do they really mean that? They're going to create a game that's going to satisfy all four of those people at the same table playing the same session. I don't know that that's actually what they mean, because what they might be meaning is we're creating a game where everybody that loves every edition or a single edition or whatever, can find enough in the next iteration to love that they will sit down at a table and play it with others.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean they're going to be sitting next to, you know, the person on their right plays first edition and never played fourth edition. The person on their left played fourth edition and second but never played third. You know, it's just, I don't know. There's so much rhetoric around everything.
And like I said, I think I read modular granularity into it, mm-hmm. which is a fancy way of saying is that there has been a trend of making things less complicated as the game progressed, mm-hmm. and less esoteric, I guess maybe is also a good way to put it. And I think they're going to try to make it in such a way that you can bolt on the granularity you want. You know, if you want to roll, you know, with just the 3d6, great. You know, or
mm-hmm.
you know, I don't know. It's difficult to put it into words, but I think that's going to be a big part of it. And that's why they say that if you've got someone used to playing first edition and then someone used to playing fourth edition, both sitting down, they can play in the same game, but they might have different levels of granularity. Now, while that makes it easy for the player, the part where I get skeptical is how does the DM manage that?
Well, but that's why I say, you know, those two people don't necessarily sit down and have the expectation to play the same game, because it's not necessarily so much in the rules, it's in what they want out of the game. If that first edition player doesn't want to use miniatures and the fourth edition player wants a heavy miniatures based game, those two people are not going to sit down and play the same game. I don't care how modular you make it, because they're not going to, you know, one of them is not going to be happy or is not going to find as much fun in that game as they are expecting.
Right.
And the thing is that for me, because I don't give a crap about Edition Wars, to me, that's okay just to say that, you know,
sure.
there are enough games for everybody. Right. But mm-hmm. you know, there seem to be pushing this point of, oh, unity, 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 and everybody can sit down at the same table. And I just, you know, and this is why I'm refraining and, you know, from typing a post up or having a Twitter conversation or having a conversation on a forum, because to say, oh, yeah, everybody can sit down at the same table, that's fine, but I want to see the rules that's going to allow that. And then I'll start saying, okay, well, here's why it works or here's why it doesn't work, or here's the parts of it that really sing and here's the parts that are tone deaf, you know,
yeah.
Because ultimately I don't know what they're doing. And to say, oh yeah, everybody can sit down and have a fun game. Well, I could say that now. Everybody can sit down and have a fun game.
Right.
You know, and it's really vague. It doesn't mean anything. It's a wonderful idea. I think it's a great, you know, goal to aspire to, and I appreciate that they're making really lofty design goals, but you know, let's be real.
Yeah, no, I agree. I can't help but agree with you there. I mean, I think that's, you know, I think it's a lofty goal. I think it's something that every company that's trying to release a new version of a product like this, and I have been trying to search both non-gaming companies and other gaming companies as to people who have tried this before, and I'm not sure there's a precedent here.
Mm-hmm.
Not one that I can readily establish. I'm not super familiar with the toy industry, so there may be a parallel somewhere in the toy industry, but I don't know. I have not seen a company really try to do it that way. Software, for example, is more an evolutionary process. I don't know. That's not the right way I want to say that. I guess each version of Dungeons & Dragons has been so different that it's not easily immediately to see
mm-hmm.
where the similarities are. There are, and I've been playing the game long enough to know where they are, but not everyone approaching the game is going to see that the way you or I would, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't know if, I mean, you could easily say to someone, well, we're still using, you know, we're going back to 4D6 for character generation. There's your hook for your first edition people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just, but
to me, like, so I think everybody has a tendency to get hung up on mechanics.
Yeah.
And they say, you know, well, are the mechanics that allow me to play the kind of game I want to play. So, of course, I want to discuss what mechanics you're going to put into the new edition. Mm-hmm. But the problem is, like, for example, that 3d6 mechanic, okay? That doesn't make any difference to how you're actually going to play that character at the table.
Right.
Okay. What it makes a difference in is in your brain how you determine, oh, that's a very old school way of doing it or whatever, right? But that is a mechanical thing. It has to do with how you assign attribute scores and what modifiers you get and yada, yada, yada. But it really doesn't make any difference to how you play. See, to me, that's where the problem is, that we're all sitting here – well, not we, because this is the first time I've really talked about mechanics, but in terms of the new iteration.
Right.
But, you know, I see a lot of people talking about discussing mechanics, what they want to see, and it's all mechanics. But nobody – because it's such a weird, ethereal, ambiguous thing, right? Nobody can really say, well, that mechanic really lends to me having that first edition feel or – you know, that is a third edition thing that I associate with third edition, and it is because at the table it makes the game play like this, mm-hmm. right? That's the kind of mechanics that we need to really be talking about that are going to affect the game, because, you know, and there's so many mechanics, right? So, and I suppose you could even, you know, somebody could make the case, well, that 4d6 does, you know, 4d6 minus the lowest does set the tone and makes it so that it plays different at the table. But I would beg to differ with that particular example. So, I mean,
I would say that it could set, and just continuing with this one example,
mm-hmm.
I would say that between that and setting your scores via a, you know, a particular...
A point by.
It's two entirely different approaches of how you build a character.
Yeah, but if you're I understand that, I get that. I'm not disputing that. But if you're at the table and your GM is running a game that relies a lot on player ingenuity and lots of skill use, but that's creative and doesn't necessarily have to have a skill particularly associated with it, other than maybe thievery, you know, the thief skills.
Mm-hmm.
How you determined what your dex and strength and all that is doesn't really, right? Just like I said, you could play fourth edition and have rolled your stats up that way.
Well, that's true, and no, you're right about that. I guess maybe while you and I know that, I don't know if that's readily apparent to everyone,
mm-hmm.
though. You and I come from a pretty unique perspective in that we've played a bunch of different versions of the game, and we've been playing it for, you know, our combined over 50 years between the two of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And that's a long time to be gaming and a long time to see a bunch of different things. But there is at least a perception, if it's not reality, there's at least a perception that in a game, in like the fourth edition of the game, we'll just take both opposite ends of the spectrum because that seems mm-hmm. to be where it's most polarized.
Right.
If you take the 4E end of the spectrum, it's easy to say, I want to be this kind of character. You pick it out, and then you've got stats to suit your stuff. Okay? Mm-hmm. It's like, you're good to go. You know you're going to be optimally, or more or less, optimally set up to play that character. Mm-hmm. If you go through the first edition method and roll the dice randomly first, and use those scores to then determine which character would be best for you.
Mm-hmm.
You're doing it the other way around. And so you fit, if you've accepted the fact that your dice may determine what kind of character you want to be, you still then have to sort of fit that mold into that, to whatever the dice have told you that you're going to be.
Or
the dice seem to indicate that you'd make a best, or you deliberately play against type.
Or you go hybrid and you roll the dice, but then you put them in the order you want to put them in to assign them to your ability scores.
Which,
that way you can be whatever class you had your heart set on.
Right, exactly. To a point. But yeah, you're right.
Sure, to a point. And people did that back in first edition too.
Oh yeah.
So
we used to roll 4d6 six times, but then do it six times.
Yeah. Yeah, and then
you pick the best array.
The set. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, we did all kinds of stuff, right? I mean, you know,
yeah.
it's. I don't know. I guess I'm just, for me, I'm just making the case for why I'm not really engaging in a lot of the conversations, because I think a lot of people are focusing on individual pieces that by themselves don't define D&D.
Yeah,
you know, the big problem that WotC had is that lots of people said fourth edition doesn't feel like D&D. Even Monty Cook, okay? Monty Cook, his attitude about fourth edition was that is not D&D. The spiritual successor to D&D is Paizo's Pathfinder.
Yeah.
And there are some reasons why, but, you know, can you find him where he posted something that gave the ten reasons why? No, you can't, because it's a feeling. It's this weird, ephemeral, ambiguous thing. But this is what I'm saying, though, is that what WotC needs to do, the design team needs to sit down and say, okay, what are the things, the characteristics, the factors that are essential D&D, that are the essence of D&D, and right. that if we change that, it makes the game no longer feel like D&D. And what they need to do is make sure that those 10 things or 20 things or 50 things or 5 things or whatever number they come up with that they decide, the design team has to decide this, whatever they decide, those are the things that have to be a certain way so that it has the essence of D&D, so that anybody who plays it, whether they're a first edition Grognard or a first edition person like you and I, which I don't consider us necessarily Grognards, or a fourth edition is the only edition they've ever played, they feel like they're playing D&D next is D&D.
Right.
Right? And everything else is where your modularity comes from. You can add this module, take away that module, do this, do that, whatever. That is the thing that's going to make the next game D&D.
Yeah, and I think you're dead on. It's about sacred cows,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of the talk is taking and trying to decide, well, what really is a sacred cow? You know, one of the things I'm going to talk about in the blog post that I'll be doing is the fact that, you know, D&D has referred to race for a long time.
Right.
But that's really a hybrid of species and culture.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been kind of an uncomfortable hybrid because, you know, if you're someone who, like Tracy, was, and I'm going to talk about her in the third person, since she's not online with us at the moment.
Stupid family obligations.
Yeah, whatever. Mom, geez. But anyway, you know, she plays against type, and she often does play against type. It's just how she likes to play. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I'm misquoting her here. And
I'm sure she'll let you know if you are.
Oh, I'm sure she will. but anyway, so one of her big deals is, you know, why should we have these races defined like they currently are? Because, you know, what if I want to play a dwarf that wields, you know, a sword instead of an axe? Or, you know, what if I, you know, want to play a, you know, a ripped elf that, you know,
you remember, remember my character,
remember
my character from the Fellowship of the Tweet?
Vaguely.
He was a dwarf who couldn't, he had no sense for finding gems or
exactly.
in the mountains.
Yeah. So
right?
Yeah, in a way that, yeah. And so I kind of discussed that and I think I actually think that the game should, it's a sacred cow that needs to be altered.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to be, you know, I think it should be choose a species, grab an attribute from that, mm-hmm. and then choose a culture. Like, do you come from the caves? Do you come from the desert? Do you come from the Arctic? Do you come, you know, in other words,
right.
have different, and then choose a feature from that, you know, one from each. That way you've got, and then you can still be, and some of those choices will be iconic, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know,
sure.
maybe direction sense or mm-hmm. gold or lust for gold or whatever, you know, you get my point.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't necessarily have to pick those. And so, you are still a dwarf, but yet, you know, dwarves don't necessarily live in mines or in caves under the mountain. Maybe they live in the plains, or they live in a small town in the valley, or, you know, they live in the forest even. But they still have, you know, you can make it more egalitarian that way, and at the same time, you can still play exactly to stereotype if you want to do that. And so,
here's what I'm saying, though. So this is the key. So I'm glad that you've just elaborated a whole lot on that one particular thing, right? Because it's a major thing. So the question is, if they take away the quote-unquote iconic-only options, right? And I know what you're saying, that it wouldn't be that you couldn't play an iconic, but what I'm saying is if they take away those specific definitions of what an elf is, what a dwarf is, what a halfling is, okay?
Right.
Because if you take all that away, someone could make the argument, well, a dwarf is just a differently shaped human then.
Right.
And a halfling is just a differently shaped human. And an elf is just a skinny human with pointy ears, right? And if that's the only difference, well, then what's the point of having an elf, right? So, but here's the thing. Here's my point. If you take that, if you take away the iconic only racial traits, does it still feel like D&D?
Right.
And if it does, then they can do that and they've hit the jackpot.
Right.
If it doesn't and they change it anyway, people are going to say D&D Next is not even D&D.
Right. No, I agree with you. You know, I think that's – and that's the gamble, you know.
Right.
Now I'm trying to remember what I was
saying. You were saying what there are, at the same time as there's a lot of people saying, oh, fourth edition,
you
like D&D
right.
for whatever reason.
Yeah, it did some things, I think, yeah. right. And one of those things, I think, and the example for me that stands out is that everybody plays.
Mm-hmm.
There is no more 5-minute work day for the wizard, mm-hmm. and that if he shoots his wad, pardon my expression,
mm-hmm.
then he's done. And all he can do is, like, plink, you know, daggers at people or mm-hmm. crossbow or whatever, or
and
what's
cower,
worse,
cower in the corner,
right, or try to hit things with a staff. So if he wants to participate, mm-hmm. he's forced to like whack things with the staff, where one, he's unlikely to hit, and two, he's squishy and a big target.
Mm-hmm.
So it puts him in a bad, him or her, sorry, I'm using male pronoun,
that's okay,
but it puts him in a big risk, and so as a result is less fun, because literally you're not doing what your class was designed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one of the things that 4E did right was, because of the use of powers, everyone, and with the at wills particularly, everyone is doing something. Everyone has something they can do. Maybe your big guns have been shot, but you've got something you could still plug in there that makes you still feel like your class as it should be.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important. I mean, it applies to other people use wizards all the time. That's the easiest example. But bards, you know, they should always have some kind of song at their lips, you know, that can mm-hmm. do some little effect. You know, a cleric should always be able to maybe heal, you know, or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's got to be always that thing in the background that they should always be able to do. Oh, she's on now. Hey, there she is.
Hello. You say that, Randall, but I would argue that that's only true if you want to play a game where everybody starts out as a very heroic PC.
I think that's beside the point.
I don't think it is, because if you look at the traditional cleric, a traditional cleric only had, you know, one or two healing spells at the ready, and otherwise they were basically a fighter who didn't fight as well as a fighter. And I'm just playing devil's advocate with everything you just said, right? So
I understand.
Yeah. So the thing is, though, that if people feel like those sort of class descriptors are very much part of the essence of D&D, you know, making it so that, you know, you're no longer, or let me rephrase that. If people feel that the sort of really uber heroic thing is fine, but it's not always the game they want to play, and you make that part of the core, you're gonna have those other people saying, well, this isn't that unity thing. This isn't making the game I want to make. And so if you start with a set of classes where they all have what you just described, you're leaving out that whole other part of people. Who did I lose? Randall.
Yeah, I'm here.
Are you there? Okay.
Yeah. Well, you had what you just described. Is yeah. what you just finished saying.
yeah, I don't know. Anyway. Hi, Tracy.
Hello!
Tracy! How's your mom?
They're doing well. Right. I even talked to my brother. It was great.
Oh,
I haven't
cool.
talked to him since my birthday, so it's been a little while.
Oh, well, excellent.
But guess what?
What?
My brother's been listening to my Twitter conversations, and he agrees with me.
Is that a good thing?
Yes!
Yes, okay. It's always good to get the familial support, yeah.
Well, and he's been playing since, like, he started in second edition, so it's...
So he's been playing a while, okay.
He's a, yeah, and he's got the whole, not really a big fan of WotC, because they TSR was the real company, and
oh wow, so he is a Grognard then.
Yes, he's a Grognard, and he agrees with me. So it doesn't mean all Grognards have to agree with me, or that there's anything wrong with being a Grognard. Just hey, it's cool that my brother agrees with me.
That's cool. Yeah. When I told my players about that they were getting ready to, that they were working on the next edition, they just all frowned at me.
Aww.
Yeah, it was like, one of them immediately went for the money grab argument. Mm-hmm. It's like, I've already spent all this money. I'm not buying another set of books. I'm not doing it. It's like, bullshit, I know you will. So,
yeah,
he doesn't know that yet.
But, he does now.
But the thing is the same guy said the same thing about 4th edition when 3.5 was out. So, like I said, if he sees it and likes it, he's going to buy it. So I ain't worried about it.
Yeah.
But, no, we were talking about, Tracy, I was actually talking about you. Your ears may have been burning. We were talking about your discussion today, particularly about, and actually yesterday too, I think, on race and stuff.
Right.
And I want to make sure I characterize your argument is that you often like to play against type. And you want the game to be able to adjust to those kinds of play styles, where you may not want to play the stereotypical dwarf or elf. You may want to play something that looks like a dwarf or an elf, but is doing something completely different with themselves. Well, am I right about that?
Yeah, and on top of it, I would say that most of the people I've seen play, and you know, everyone has their own play style, and I haven't seen everyone, so. But a lot of the people I've seen play.
Wait, you mean you're not omniscient?
I know. So the hard part is, like, if somebody else telling me that they like to play type doesn't dismiss my argument, but, like, okay, a lot of it has to do with percentages, and if we're going to do the big tent unification of D&D thing, if there are enough people who play in a particular play style and have had the rules support that, at some point we do kind of have to give them something, right?
Right.
And I think that if you look at a lot of novels and the inspiration for these characters, the protagonists tend to be someone who in some way breaks with the norms of their background.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be in every way, but usually they have something that's different, and they often get a different bonus for being that way. You don't have to, they don't pay that penalty of, well, you know, yeah, sure, it's great that I get the +1 to damage on axes because I'm a dwarf, but, you know, I'm just going to ignore that, but I'm going to spend a feat to get spears because my group really did spears, sort of thing.
Right, which is in essence a penalty because you're now having to do something extra to be able to roleplay your character like you want.
Right, and as Steve Winter pointed out in his column, in his blog post, what ends up happening in the D&D rules is that somebody creates a dwarf sub race or like a different group who, well, okay, fine. They decide to braid their beards, but they use spears. And that way they can get it for free.
Right.
Well, and one of the things that I was telling Sam, and this is going to be in my blog post on Thursday, because I'm addressing this very topic. Some other people have too, and I think it's an important one because I think it's one of those, like I said, it's this sacred cow, if you will, that Sam and I were talking about earlier. And I think that
we were making all kinds of really bad cow metaphors because we mentioned the sacred cows in the pasture. But anyway,
yeah, sorry, the internet fixed that for us, so we didn't talk about it. So, but anyway, I think that D&D historically has treated race as meaning actually species and culture. Okay.
Right.
And so I think that really the game needs to separate it. And I propose one way to do that, and that's simply pick a species, which is your elf, dwarf, whatever, and I give a simple example, and then pick a culture. But in each of those categories, there are, like, for example, dwarf, elf, halfling. You would have three or four things that every dwarf, elf, or halfling has about them. It's nature to their genetics. It's part of their species. It may be, but you would pick one of those things, okay? When you create your character, you pick one. Not the whole list, but one of them. And then also you would pick a culture. And like, for example, you might have – and I think the best way to relate culture is by environment because I think those are the largest contributing factors.
Right.
But I think – so you would have like maybe someone that are coastal or cavern dwellers or city dwellers or forest or desert or arctic. You see what I'm saying? And then under each of those categories, you would have another set of possible, and you pick one from that.
Right.
And so this way you have a couple of features. You're still a dwarf. You're as much a dwarf as you are in the Arctic as you are in the traditional mine, if you will. But you might have slightly different... not every dwarf is going to look the same that way. And I think that's a good thing. And I think it opens it up for people that don't want to play the stereotypical Gimli. But mm-hmm. at the same time, but gives the features in there still, that if you want to play Gimli, you can still play Gimli if you want. And not be penalized either way.
And so, Tracy, the my sort of response to that was, I totally agree, first of all, but
yeah.
the problem that the design team is going to have is what they need to do is boil down all the mechanics and everything that sort of surrounds all the additions of D&D, and they need to figure out what things are the essence of D&D, such that if you change that and then you play that way, it no longer feels like D&D. Because if they do too much of that, this next iteration is not going to fly, because people are going to say, this doesn't feel like D&D. So the whole racial and the whole racial based things is great, but if you change it too much, you're going to get some portion of the population that says, well, now that you've changed it, there aren't these iconic things, or there's some iconic things but not enough, and so it doesn't feel like D&D. If enough of the population of players does that, they're going to have a problem. So I don't disagree with you, but my thing is the designers are going to have a really hard time balancing something like that. And I hope they do it, because it sounds awesome, but it's going to be hard for them, because as soon as they move too far away from what is D&D, or what someone considers the essence of a part of D&D, that if if they change it, it's going to not be D&D.
So we should just make elves and dwarves classes again?
No. I'm not saying that.
I know you're not. But at the same time, we've provided options in the past mm-hmm. in D&D for races. In everything I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, we have some group of dwarves who get to break the core mold, and I don't know. And I get it to a degree. I think both having core classes and then breaking them apart in future rules updates are both sacred cows of D&D. So that's what, I'm tired of that.
mm-hmm.
I think it's kind of silly to bloat the rules continuously, because we do have these two core audiences who one wants something, they want to play Lord of the Rings basically, and the other group wants to play a character that's unique to the culture that it comes from.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean the poll is very small, I know. But it was interesting that it was 60-40 in favor of mechanics. It wasn't more than 60. I think that's pretty interesting to me.
Right.
Yeah, I haven't actually seen the poll, so.
Yeah, it was on the D&D Next community site.
Yeah.
Monty had a little post. And it's cool. I don't know. The things that new players need an iconic D&D racial class in order to know how to play a race just don't hold water with me.
But that's not even what I'm saying, though.
I know it's not. Yeah.
What I'm saying is this exact thing that we're talking about is the some of the main problems that the D&D Next design team is going to face, right?
I think Sam is just identifying the fact that this will be a challenging issue mm-hmm. and it's something that will have to be ironed out if the game is to succeed. And I think that goes,
I just wanted to point out about the new player thing. Mm-hmm. It's bugging me.
Yeah. But
I actually think the nice thing about the idea that I have is of separating the, and I know it's not just my idea. It's a lot of people have come up with this obvious conclusion. But I think one of the things that makes it nice is the fact that if you've got a specific campaign setting, like Eberron or Dark Sun, you can then bolt on. Yeah. Your additional cultures. And so, well, see, this is, you're this still is, a basic dwarf, and you still choose those. You may have an Eberron culture, and then you have a Dark Sun culture types.
But you know what you're describing? I'll tell you exactly what you're describing. You're describing the way that basic D&D did, and this is way back when dwarves and elves were classes, right? But you couldn't be a dwarven cleric. Dwarf was your class and your race. However, what happened was they came out with the Gazetteer series for Mystara, and so, for example, the Dwarves of Rockholm supplement, the Gazetteer, had, you know, dwarven cleric rules in it. So now suddenly you can be a dwarven cleric. Even though dwarf was your race slash class put together, now you could actually have a little bit of specialization. That's exactly what you're describing. Okay. It has a historical precedent. But the problem is, how much of that can you do without going so far backwards that you're no longer satisfying the newer, more modern players?
But see, Sam, what I'm not talking about class at all here. I'm simply talking about how they've treated race up to this point.
Yeah, no, I was just giving an example and just pointing out that that was back when dwarves were still a class. But even if it was a race, you couldn't be you had certain restraints because you were that race. And one of the restraints was you could not be a cleric. But then they came out with a supplement later where suddenly now you can be a cleric.
Right.
Right, that's my only point.
Okay. But that's I'm even separating it a little further than that. I'm not telling you whether or not I haven't even told you yet whether or not certain races can play certain classes. At this point, I'm going on the assumption that they've done with basically 3.0 on is that any race could basically play any class.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going on that assumption because there's certain things that I think aren't going to be dropped because they actually made the game better to play.
Mm-hmm.
and more fun to play because of choices available. Mm-hmm. So I think that you know, I see what you're saying, and you're right. As far as you can get to a point where you go, well, it's just wide open for everything. Why play any races at all? But at the same time, I think if you can give the choices that are iconic within the choice structure, then you'll satisfy those people because it's like, oh, well, the choices that I would normally make anyway or that would be a dwarf anyway are right here. I'll just choose these. And so that's the same thing. So at least as far as I'm concerned. So I think that works out well. I'm hoping something like that will happen. I don't know. Maybe it won't.
And in the course of doing that, you would basically give the DM lots of examples of things that are approximately equivalent so that if the DM wants to create their own, like if a player comes to a DM or if the DM just wants to create their own races, they could, like their own benefits according to race. The problem right now is, you know, a lot of people reply to me, oh, well, you know, the DM can just do it. And I was like, well, I am a DM. I'd like a little more guidance.
Yeah.
Sorry. You know, and I think it gets to a deeper issue that not necessarily everyone agrees with or cares about, but I feel like this whole having attributes based on race is kind of a topic that makes some people pretty uncomfortable. You know, I don't want all of orc kind to be boiled down to 3 racial attributes. I want there to be orcs that are a little different.
Well, and I actually don't even cover attributes because I actually believe that they need to eliminate attributes adjustments for races.
And I meant it in a more general term, like any of the mechanical stuff, like boiling down all of orcs to a set of mechanical benefits just kind of is weird to me. I get that it's been in the history of the game, but I don't know. It's to me, it's like having gender or age mechanics.
Yeah. Gender. Well, it was one of the things that, I mean, I think I made a joke on Twitter when they were talking about, you know, the fact that I think it was Von Hinman that was talking about the fact that women could only get strength of up to 1850 or whatever, something like that. Or he was referring to that chart.
Right.
And I was like, well, I mean, gnomes get totally screwed. They can't have exceptional strength at all.
Yeah.
Their highest strength is like 16. It's like gnomes get totally the short end of the stick. I want my Arnold Schwarzenegger gnome. So, you know, but anyway, but you're right. I mean, I think some of those things need to go by the wayside. I'm not sure mechanical attributes like that. I think that there should be some kind of racial flavor. And and the kind of things that I suggest in the post, and like I said, you'll have to say wait till Thursday, but some of the things that I suggest are generic enough. I don't mean them as actual rules. They're more examples of anything else, because, you know, I'm not saying this is what I want it to be like. I'm just giving examples out of the kinds of things that you might see, you know, and so, but I think that that's what it should be like, and it's, and not hardcore, none of the plus to hit stuff, you know, none of the, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
They're more things that generally, you know, maybe you can see in the dark if you're a dwarf.
Yeah.
Makes sense. It's a genetic trait. Maybe as a halfling, you know, you're going to be short. You're a halfling.
Right.
You're short. So that means that maybe people can shoot over your head. You know, they don't block line of sight. I think that's an important attribute to have. I don't know how often that has come into case in my game where people want to know where Lyrica, my wife's character, is standing because she's short and I let them see over their head without blocking line of sight. So, yeah, it's a big deal, you know, in my game. So, you know, but so it's an important, it becomes an important racial attribute. It's like, hey, you know, if I'm short, that means you can shoot over my head and I don't block your line of sight. That's a cool thing for the archers to have. And so, but anyway, I digress. But,
well, and
those
could,
kinds of things, yeah.
And you could do other things, too, that they can be expressed as mechanics, but don't necessarily have to be, like, you know, dwarves and elves don't get along together. So if you're talking to an elf, unless you have an ongoing relationship or the DM decides that this is a more enlightened elf, you may not get along very well at first.
Or the shopkeepers all try to charge elves more or less, or that stuff. So the thing is, you can have like one mechanical thing per race that has nothing to do with like a plus two here or a plus two there, but like what Randall's saying, halflings could be, you know, that because they're short, you know, they've got the whole not blocking line of sight thing. You could say, well, that, and then there's, you know, one other thing that halflings that happens to be the case because of their stature and their body shape and all that stuff, just racial stuff. And then have things that are just basically flavor things, like what you just described with the shopkeeper. And then you can actually give guidelines and say, if you want to make this, you know, something that is very consistent in your game, you can say, you know, a shopkeep, if they're not elven themselves, they're going to charge elves 10% more, or try to charge elves 10% more. Or maybe they just won't haggle with elves, but they'll haggle with anybody else, you know.
Right.
And stuff like that, where you could either choose to use the mechanical part of it or not. But it's not you get a -2 to strength because you're a winnowy elf and you don't have the ability to build muscle in your forearm, you know.
Right.
I mean, give me a break.
Yeah.
And is everybody going to like it? Not necessarily, but everybody doesn't like their current stuff either. So
I think the way is to give choices that allow to play against type, but still allow the people that want the traditional way of playing to be able to play that way.
Right.
And then at the same time reduce a little bit the number of choices so that you're not getting into the bloat of, oh my god, I gotta look through 10,000 things to decide what I want.
Right.
You know, you give three or four things that a dwarf it can do, you pick one. You know, and you get three or four things that maybe someone living in the desert can do. You pick one. And some of those things might be redundant. It's quite possible that maybe long distance runner, you know, maybe you have a little bit better endurance when you're running through open plains or when you're running through the desert. So maybe those overlap. And so in both of those categories, you have that same thing. So there can be overlap. They don't all have to be totally unique, special flowers. They can there can be overlap in them. But you know that,
Randall, we're all unique special flowers.
Yeah, I hate to break the news to you, Sam.
and actually I was looking at the Essentials books, and there are a few that actually do stuff like that already, particularly with the Fae. Why is word messing up on me? There are a couple of Fae ones, like Fae origin is common. That obviously makes sense to a degree.
Mm-hmm.
Where was the other one? I saw another one, but I forget what it is right now. But there is some overlap. The trance with the drow and the eladrin.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that's one. And, of course, several species have low light vision.
Right.
Several have, I don't know about some of the weirder races, but I know a couple have dark vision. So, you know, But yeah, I think you're right. And but that's, it's been a big topic of conversation, and
yeah,
it's been kind of interesting. So the other thing you really missed is that we were talking about the first edition books coming out.
Woohoo!
Yeah, that's got to be fun to have.
I told Fred about them, and he's like, well, we're going to get them, right?
Hell yeah!
I want to get them. They're, it's a little expensive, but it's going to a good cause, so.
Yeah. Anna looked at me and says, because I told her about it, she said, save your money. And I go, yeah. Usually I get one little perk every in the wintertime about March, and this is what usually ends up paying for the first part of Gen Con, is I get a little bonus for my for work, and I always get a little piece that goes to myself. Doesn't have to go to family stuff. So I'm hoping the little piece will be me being able to buy the first edition rule set. Yeah, it's not, it's stuff I've all seen before, but the new covers will look nice, and I think they'll look nice on the bookshelf. So that's
yeah. Yeah, probably for me it'll be the money I get from the column will go to.
Hey, there you go. See, that's. But and reinvesting and learning the old ways, Tracy.
Yes, because
remember, Sam and I have implored you to learn the old ways.
I have to learn the old ways. I have to be assimilated.
That's right.
I think Tracy's gonna read like 20 pages of High Gygaxian, and she's gonna burn the inside of the book.
She's gonna get to the D20 chart about what harlots or what prostitutes you find on the street.
Yeah,
and just blow a gasket. But yeah,
no, I just rewrite it.
Yeah, there you go.
I will create my own version of the game.
That's exactly right. Well, everyone does that anyway, so that's pretty much true.
That's how I've been feeling of late. It's like, I'll just create my own. Enough with this. I'm not going to... I'm just going to create it. You guys can buy it or not. I don't care.
So as you were coming on, I was talking about the other end of the coin. It's like there are some funny things that 4E did that I thought should be kept, definitely, because I thought they actually improved gameplay. And having played a bunch of different versions, I thought it was fairly fairly knowledgeable in the fact that, yeah, this improved the game. And right. I think one of the big ones was for me is that everybody plays. And that regardless of your class, you're still given a little something you can do each round. That you can identify as being something that your class could do.
Right.
You know, so none of this, you know, even if... And that's one of the reasons I did the post about the wizard weapons, was because it was a way that I thought you could still have a wizard kind of doing wizardly things, even if you're using a Vancian magic system. And he had already shot all of his spells or her spells, and you could still do something with this weapon, which is a wizardly weapon, but is wizardly in nature, if you will.
Right.
And so, and that was the whole point of that post, but it was...
So you're talking about, like, wands and stuff that have a spell that have, like, 50 charges.
Well, I'm actually not talking about charges at all. I'm actually talking about, and you'd have to go to the post, it's on This Is My Game, but I feel like I'm tooting my own horn a lot tonight. Wow, I don't really usually do that.
Put the trumpet down, Randall.
Yeah, I know it. I've just been writing more recently, so I guess that's what the... So, support your local This Is My Game, under new management, yay! Okay. It's, you know, like, for example, and it was kind of a WoW thing, a little bit of a WoW flavor, but I like the idea of a wizard who has a staff that when he hits an opponent with a staff, polymorphs it until the end of the guy's next turn. Or yeah. And so, and while it's in that state, he can't be harmed, but it sort of takes him out of combat. So you've got a wizard polymorphing things, okay? Maybe he changes them to a toad or a sheep or whatever it is going to be, right? But it's one thing he can do. It's not uber powerful because it's not killing anybody. It's not damaging. It's not putting out hit points. But it's taking that combatant out of the picture for a short, very brief period of time and can aid but still seems wizardly, okay? I don't know if that makes any sense at all, but...
It's not... I mean, so a lot of the old spells used to do stuff like that, though, right? Like, I want to say Color Spray, but I don't think it is Color Spray.
But they were Fire and Forget. See, once you cast that spell, they were done. You couldn't cast it again.
Oh, yeah.
And so, until you rested. Okay, so, you know, and the thing about the 5-minute workday is a big problem for some players. I could tell you right now, if we were using a Vancian system, it's unlikely my wife would want to play a Warlock or any character like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because she would be bored. It's like, well, my spells are done. What am I going to do now? You know?
Right. And on top of it, everybody, like, in the very old games, I think there were fewer of these, but, like, in one of the Pathfinder games I played recently, we didn't have a healer, so somebody just bought a wand that had, or what, I forget what exactly implement it was, but it has healing spells.
Like a wand to cure, like, wounds or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it had 50 of them.
Right.
Like, you know what we didn't have to care about? Healing.
Well, yeah. And you could break, you could so break 3-5 doing stuff like that. You'd get characters that would, once they got to the ability to make their own magic items, it was ugly.
Right.
It's like, well, we have 6 wands of heal.
And I swear there's a feat somewhere, I could be wrong, that lets you use it as a miner or something. I don't know.
Oh, yeah, I think so. It's just
The equivalent of a miner. I know there wasn't a miner then, but.
But yeah, I get most of my 3-5 information now from Order of the Stick, so. Which is hysterical.
And my problem is like, yeah, I know a lot of people like that they figured those things out, and so that makes people feel good, and I get that, because I mean I've totally been there. But I just sometimes I wonder if enough people do it, if we just shouldn't say, hey, you know, something's going on here that maybe we should look at. And we can do stuff like that by class, I think, to get to, because Sam's point, I think, in response was that some people want to play quote-unquote zeros.
No, my response was more to the... So Randall was talking about like a spellcaster who always has a spell at the ready, and there's always healing at the ready, and everything is always at the ready, even at first level.
Yep.
That's not exactly what I meant, Sam. I may have misspoke, but that's not exactly what I meant, though. I meant always having something to do. I don't mean... And the healing one was and for clerics was probably a bad example.
Well, that's the one I was replying to, though.
Right.
Because
yeah, I know.
My reply was, well, you know, in 2E and in AD&D, a cleric had like one cure light wound spell, not even at first level. You had to,
right.
You know, you had to pray for it every night, and then wake up and you would suddenly have the spell again, and you only had one or two, and it was not, you didn't even get your first one until second level. And, you know, and that's so for that reason, clerics were basically fighters that didn't fight as good as fighters, but they had this, you know, they could heal every once in a while.
I remember.
Yeah.
So, you know, that, you know, if you just make everybody able to heal, you don't need a cleric, which some, you know, some part of the population will say, well, that's wonderful. I don't have to worry about carrying around a freaking cleric in my party. But the other part of the population will say, yeah, but that's what makes the cleric awesome at their job, is that everybody gets hurt at some time. Mm-hmm. And the cleric is there to sort of save the day that one time, you know, and that's what makes the cleric cool. Whereas if everybody can heal, well, you know, there's nothing special about a cleric now.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things. What makes a cleric iconic? Is it his healing power? Is it his ability? See, for me, and this is totally my perspective, because I'll tell you what. You know what first hooked me on to D&D? I don't know if I've told this story or not, but a friend of mine was sitting in geography class next to me, and he was writing out a table. He was expanding the table in the basic handbook of clerics versus undead.
Mm-hmm.
He was writing it out by hand, and he was expanding the table to higher levels. And I asked him what it was, and he told me, and I said, that sounds frickin' cool.
Mm-hmm.
And thus started a very long journey. But my point is that, you know, it, maybe that's the iconic thing about clerics, their ability to turn undead.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, and I'm not actually arguing that. My point was still going back to my whole, you know, if a big enough portion of the player base feels that healing and divine magic and turning undead are both iconic aspects of a cleric, and you take one of those away, or you make it so that one of them is not needed, you're going to get people who say, well, this doesn't feel like D&D then.
Right. Yeah.
That was my whole point. I am not even espousing that idea myself. I'm just saying that this is the main issue. So, Tracy, when we first began podcasting...
I agree with that.
Yeah, I was saying that I'm staying away from Twitter conversations and forum conversations and all that stuff because, you know, I think part of the problem is that everybody said, oh, open playtest. Now, if they want our opinions and they're just spewing all these opinions, and I'm not invalidating the opinions and I'm not invalidating the fact that people want to get their voices heard. But what happens is there's lots of crosstalk, and yet what the problem that the design team is going to have is having to boil down D&D to its essence, and they have to figure out what is the essence, what are the five things or the 10 things that absolutely make D&D feel like D&D at the table. And what they have to do is figure those things out and not change those. And everything else is what can change, and everything else is what can go into that sort of modularity that they're talking about. And as long as anybody sitting at the table, whether they've only ever played first edition or fourth edition, if they sit down and when they play they say, this feels like D&D, then D&D Next will be a hit. But all the stuff that we're talking about now is stuff that at some level they're going to have to decide. Okay, are these racial characteristics? Is that the essence? Is that the essence of D&D? And a cleric's healing power, is that the essence of D&D, or is it just the sort of divine turning ability? Or is it both, right? These are the things that the design team's going to have to decide.
Right. Yeah, and I think Sam's pretty much right on that one, because I think that that's the only way you can tear it apart and rebuild like that, so...
And my problem is I think even if they figured out that and everybody thought it was D&D, doesn't necessarily make it fun. Is my problem.
Yeah, and you might be right. I mean, and that's the issue with Unity, right? If you want to unify, you know, 3.5 decades of gaming into one system that's going to make everybody happy, that's a big job. And I was saying before, you know, I applaud the sort of lofty goals, but I'm also a realist, and I'm not so sure that it's possible because it's just the three of us sitting here could have different ideas about what is the one thing that makes D&D feel like D&D, and is it important enough, and is it so essential to being D&D that you can't change it at all?
Right, and that's a tough thing and I would have to say that I'm not sure I could point my finger to one thing. You know.
Well, I think for me, it's the problem is not that you can't point out one thing. It's that I think sort of more modern players, they want a lot of modularity, and it's sort of more thin. What the essence is more thin, right? Whereas a first edition player might be able to, you know, pick out 10 things that, oh yes, if it doesn't have this, it's not going to feel like D&D, because they're sort of more... they're more sort of immersed in that style of play, and the style is directly married to lots of the mechanics. Whereas, for example, 4th edition, one of the things that is really great about it is really modular already. Mm-hmm. And you can do a lot of things already and make a lot of different choices. And because it's so easy to DM, if you have a lot of experience and you feel really comfortable, you can try different things and figure out what works and what doesn't work within some, you know, whatever your boundary is for your campaign. And move on from there, and it can still feel like your game. Whereas first edition players are not necessarily, you know, the old school Renaissance people are much more married to mechanics defining how a game style should be played. And fourth edition and more modern players, you know, who maybe were introduced to RPGs much later, are not that way. And it's going to be really hard to marry those two groups of people.
Well, and what's funny is I think there's still dissension even in the OSR community about how much that sort of mechanics matters.
Sure, absolutely, yes. I absolutely agree. I totally agree.
Because I think there's some that I've read that would probably bristle a little bit at that. Because they don't... they like a modular system too, to the degree that they're just going to change it however they want to change mm-hmm. it.
I agree. But the thing is that it's sort of hard to explain what I mean. Because it's so ambiguous and it's this weird essence thing, and so what I was saying to Randall earlier, Tracy, was, you know, Monty Cook doesn't like, you know, when 4th edition first came out, he really sort of balked at 4th edition, and he said, you know, oh, they did this change and they did that change, and it really doesn't feel like D&D, and really the spiritual successor to D&D is Pathfinder, right? But he never, like, wrote a list of, here's why it doesn't feel like D&D. You know, here are the four things that make it not D&D, or that feel specifically not like D&D that Pathfinder has. You know why? Because it's a frickin' feeling. That's why. Because it's an essence thing that has to do with when you started playing, what was going on in your life, how old you were, the group you were playing with, and how you personally identified with the game. That's what makes it D&D. It's impossible for WotC to take, you know, 2 million players and drill down to the essence that is common between all of those people.
Well, it's the same problem with pizza. Pizza is whatever
right.
form of pizza you yeah. first had as a kid. That is pizza to you. And anything else is an abomination upon the earth.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least a sad second, because really pizza is pretty awesome, like in multiple forms, but still.
Well, okay,
but now you're
a
polypizzaist.
But here's the thing, though. So you're right. D&D is like pizza, but it's also like a chair, in the Platonic sense, right? So, if you Plato had this thing where he said there's a pure form of everything, right? And so you know what a chair is. And if I say to you, imagine a chair. The three of us just now, when I said that, imagined a chair. Each one of us imagined a different chair. But there were some characteristics that still made that thing a chair. And if someone else was asked, if they saw the picture that we had in our head, what is that thing? That person, that fourth person would say, oh, that's a chair, because it has the essence of being a chair. Right?
It's the same as the pizza argument, but yeah.
It's the expression that the Supreme Court said. It's like, mm-hmm. you know, I can't define porn, but right. I know it when I see it.
Yeah.
You know, right. It's like, I don't know, I can't define D&D, but I know it when I see it.
Well,
you know?
Right.
And this has been my big problem with the polls and the articles on the Wizards site and stuff like that, is that, yeah, sure, we can find some mechanics that we loosely think form D&D. But to be honest, a lot of other games have those same mechanics too, and a lot of them have the same combinations for the most part too. So that doesn't necessarily make D&D either. A lot of the things that we're not talking about that I'd like to talk about, at least, are the other parts, like how players interact with D&D, because a lot of people interact with D&D differently than they would another game, even though that game has the same mechanics. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, a lot of players really like the complex rules that have the multiple layers, because it's a reward to you for some players, it's a reward as they delve deeper and they start understanding how these complex things interact, because it wasn't obvious at first. When they finally get it, it's a reward and it pushes them forward.
Mm-hmm.
And if we make simple rule sets that don't obfuscate as much, people aren't going to get that reward, and they're not going to feel like it's D&D, because to them, D&D was sitting through these books and trying to figure out all this arcana in it, like all this arcane information that just doesn't make any sense to a modern person.
Right.
Like, they liked that part of that own personal exploration and journey into the rule system that you don't necessarily get in other games, and you don't necessarily get in newer games, sorry.
Can I ask you a question then, based on what you just said? And I totally agree with you, by the way, but let me throw this out there.
Yeah.
Perhaps the thing that really makes D&D was lost partly in 3.5 and partly in 4.0, maybe because, you know, back in first edition, really only the GM knew all the rules for a long period of time. And players were constantly discovering things. you know, because they didn't necessarily know how every single thing worked. There wasn't a rule for every single thing, and there wasn't, you know, there was lots of mystery around how something is going to work or how something is going to be determined or turn out, because they didn't know exactly what the rule was that governed that particular physical element in the universe. Whereas with 3.5 and 4th edition, everything is written down. There's a rule that describes how to adjudicate every single thing. And if there's not, you write into the forums and get an answer from one of the designers, right? And the players do that, too. It's not just GMs. So maybe...
We've had that forever.
Right.
Each article.
Oh, sure. But, yeah. But you get my point, though, right? I mean, I know there's been, and it's not, you know, I mean, I've been reading, even when I wasn't DMing, I knew the rules because I was DM part of the time and not all the time, you know. So it's not, I know I'm saying it as though it's absolutes, but it's not absolutes, of course. But,
right. But
I mean, it is that part of it? Because what you're basically describing is there's some sense of mystery and figuring things out that really adds to the game.
Well, but here's the deal. If you've played for 30 years,
mm-hmm.
How are you going to get that mystery?
I don't know.
Well,
I can't answer that question.
And yet again, I covered that in a blog post. Here we go. I actually talked about the different editions and what I felt was important about them. In other words, and what they meant to me.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things about the first edition particularly was that I mentioned is that it felt scholarly. When you read the information at that time, I was learning all kinds of new terms. I didn't know what a melee was until
right.
I read the Dungeon Master's Guide. I had no idea what that term meant. It had never occurred to me. It was never in my popular school. It was never in a book, you know, fiction. I just never read that stuff. But when I read it in this, I'm like, wow, I had to look that shit up. And I'm like,
yeah.
What is that? And so there was a, and yes, Tracy, I think you're right a little bit. Well, there was a little bit of a reward with that. And I think some of the people, I think there is a faction of the group that plays this game that feels that if it's not complicated, it's not worth it, because that was what it all meant to me. Because I was able to do something someone else was not able to do.
Right.
Which I think is kind of a shame and sort of closed-minded, but it's I see where they're getting at. But it was written in such a way that you felt like you were being educated while you were learning how to play a game at the same time. And so there was like this two levels of value.
But at the same time, though, in later editions, you're never going to feel that way because
exactly.
You've already learned those things.
Mm-hmm.
You're
so
exactly
I think
right.
People who start off with the newer edition are still going to go through that. Except for the fact that a lot of them have already played RPGs before. Like, most of them have played computer or video RPGs by the time they play D&D.
But let me give you an example. My wife is a perfect example of someone who came in virtually new to the game and did not have any experience with video games and only had played one version of second edition, and that was a one-time event.
Right.
So, and that had been 10 years plus previous. So there are, I think, exceptions to that. But I think you're right. But at the same time, having read 4E and being familiar with it, I do not get the same scholarly sense to it. There is a much more modern style to writing game rules and things like that, which I understand why they may do that. But it doesn't add that layer to it anymore. I was going to mention that, like, in second edition, one of the things that did make it seem new were all of the new worlds.
Right.
I mean, so many different worlds. You were now, instead of exploring what role-playing games in a medieval-type fantasy meant,
right.
Now that you've got that, now you've got this opportunity to explore new worlds. And so you're going to Dark Sun, you're going to Void Space, you're going to Planescape, you know, to the outer planes with Planescape. And it's all these new exciting areas. And there's a whole other branch of topic that talks about D&D in those specific areas. But, I mean, that was the thing that was exciting for me about the second edition. And we muddled through first and second edition. And I say muddled because really we used miniatures, but we used them basically to determine our party, our marching order. I mean, we
right.
would set a little cardboard stock piece out. and then we put the characters on it, like, here's our marching order. And we really wouldn't do much. We would do stuff on maps on occasion, and we would point to things on our regular little, you know, quarter-inch graph paper map, and do things like that and kind of get a general feel where everybody was at, but we never used miniatures. Well, one of the things that was exciting about the third edition was, wow, boom, now we have rules for miniatures. Now I can see what's going on when it's actually happening. And right. As a DM, I can now put things in their place, and I know where they're going, and I don't have to worry about losing track. And I loved that about the third edition. That's what made it important. And then finally, with fourth edition come along, we come back circle, and it's like, now, wow, now everyone can play equally. Everyone has the same opportunity to participate in the gaming experience because they're always able to do something with your at-will powers particularly. And so, you know, it's kind of a progression, but you're right. The longer that you have played the game, the more difficult it's going to be to recapture those initial feelings that were given. So,
well, and it's harder to remember, too, that people who are new to the game may actually have the same sort of, well, maybe not exactly the same. So if you started in the 80s before there are other RPGs available, regardless of the format, like mm-hmm. tabletop versus computer versus video or whatnot, they're still going to have that initial, like, oh, wow, I'm playing this game. They're not going to, some new players care about playing. One of the biggest things that bugs me sometimes in talking to people is that there's this assumption that somebody as a new player, whoever that new player is going to care about playing a dwarf the way D&D says you should play a dwarf. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, no, they want to have fun with the rules. They want to play. They don't care about the rules. The rules are just there to help them do what they're going to do. Some players may care about rules, so I don't want to, I know somebody will just write in saying I'm overgeneralizing, but I think a lot of people, if all they cared about were the rules, they may just play a video game. Mm-hmm. It's the ability to just go and do crazy shit like every kid does with the game. Every new player at the beginning is like, oh, I can do this. Well, what about this? What about this? And they get really excited about it. And then if you come in too quickly and say, well, that's not D&D because you're not playing
you can't do
these
that.
Rules.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, that just kills it. Mm-hmm. It kills the fun to me of those people. Let them explore. And the thing is they've grown up in these more modern times. They have different ways of viewing the world, and let them view the world that they want to. So I don't know how D&D Next is going to do any of that stuff, because that's just, if we're uniting all the previous editions, there's no room for that.
It's a ghostly target. I mean, it's tough. Yeah. That's going to be one. It's going to be tough. Mm-hmm. It's a moving one, and it's tough to pin down. And it goes to Sam saying, you know, it's about the feel, you know, and someone who's two different new people to the game could be looking at it completely differently, you know. So it'll be challenging, and I think the next year or so will be very interesting with the playtests and things that happen to find out what's going to shake out.
Yeah.
And, you know, at some point, hard decisions will have to be made. I don't envy the designers, actually. I mean, what a great opportunity for them. But I mean, I would really be pulling my hair out because I think all of the people that are on the design team really care about the game. I think that, you know, I don't think any of them are just phoning it in to get a paycheck by any means. And I will challenge anyone who wants to suggest otherwise. And I think that they care about the game. They want to see it succeed. And they want people to have fun. And so I think, you know, they've got a good set of people to do that. So, but I don't envy their task, because it's going to be, there'll be some hair pulling moments, I'm sure. I'm, you know, just as much as the public is, I'm sure they're all invested in what they each think D&D should be.
Oh, totally.
And so at some point, two people are going to say, well, this is what's going in and your idea is not. And, you know, that's going to be hard. So, tough deal. But.
And then somewhere, sometime, someone's going to say, oh, why'd they do that way? They should have done it this way. And that person's going to say, well, yeah.
I just hope the new rules don't look like a bunch of notes. Sometimes when I read some of the 3.5 stuff, like my favorite, The Gaze Attack. It really reads like somebody
The Gaze Attack? What?
The Great Gaze Attack rules were
Gaze Attack.
Gaze. Not, like Medusas gaze and Cataplepuses and stuff like that. Yeah,
yeah, sorry.
No, it's
you
okay.
Said The Gaze Attack and I thought, what?
Oh, now I'm picking it up.
Are you getting
it's
it?
Like,
yeah.
I wasn't even thinking along those
I
lines.
Thought you were referencing a typo or something, and I was like, what? No, what book is that in?
No, that would be an interesting typo to be So it reads kind of like
Jesus.
Somebody had a game, and the players really argued this, and so now it's part of the rules.
Mm-hmm.
Or the DM. I don't know if.
But see, that's exactly what I was trying to get at. I wasn't necessarily talking about, how the rule set that you start with is the one that becomes sort of what defines D&D for you. I was talking about that a little bit, but I was mostly talking about how, you know, there's a freaking rule for everything, and the players know all the rules.
Right.
You know, and you're right. At first, they don't really care about the rules. They just want to do cool shit and have fun, and that's what they do. But once they've played, most people, and I'm generalizing, of course, this isn't true for everybody, but most people, once they play for a while, they learn more and more rules just from using them. And then they think they know how something should work, and then they can argue it, and then eventually it has to get codified so that there aren't arguments at every table in America. Right. So
right.
It's exactly what you're saying is that that's sort of thing started with 3.0 and 3.5 and came into 4.0. And it doesn't mean that people didn't have fun and that people don't like sort of that kind of thing. But it's one of those things that, you know, it's part of the thing that takes some of the mystery away is that when you know every single rule and when you know that there is a rule that determines how to adjudicate every single thing.
Right.
At some point you learn all those and there's no mystery.
And that really speaks to the shift in power between, as the editions have continued, between from the DM to the player. Mm-hmm. And such, I mean, particularly when you talk about rules mastery. And so, you know, no longer are you looking to, is the DM, in fact, shoot, half the time I ask my players, is this right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, because they're the right. ones that know their characters mm-hmm. and they know what their powers can do. And hell, I don't have, as a DM, I can't know every player's power.
Right.
I have
well,
no
that's
clue.
That's the that's sort of a collateral effect of the exception based rule system, right?
Well, yeah,
well,
I think so.
And what's funny is I don't want to know it.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, as a DM, I really don't care. So you
right,
know,
right.
you know, I know you're going to do some cool stuff, and it's going to cause damage and affect my creatures. So you know, just let me
right.
know what it is. But
yeah.
at the same time. I mean, because all the powers and things are standardized, if as soon as you know kind of the area that a monster is doing, you know what, if mm-hmm. a monster shifts, you know what that means, you know,
yeah.
or if a monster
yeah.
pushes, you know what that means because your character can probably do something mm-hmm. similar. And
right.
so, again, you've lost mystery, you've lost some of the uniqueness of, oh crap, how do we deal with this? That's one of the... I'm hoping that one of the other things that they'll address when it starts to come to writing adventures and things is I want to see a return to when players go into a room, the stuff that they need to figure out that encounter is in the room. It's either going to involve them or items in the room, and they have to think about problem solving because that was a big part of D&D that I think has kind of gone away some. I think some of the heavy lifting has been done, and... the players no longer have to think real hard about how to solve a certain encounter. And I have issues with that. You know, I think that's part of the fun of being a DM is being able to challenge your players. Sure, can it be abused? Oh, you betcha it can. But that when you flip it, that was the challenge for the players. It's like, we're going to be able to solve this room and come up with some crazy whack stuff that's going to blow the DM away. And if the DM is cool about it, I'm one of those, if they come up with some cool idea, man, do it. Go for it. Because
mm-hmm.
I think that's awesome. And it teaches me to design my encounters better if they can break them. You
right.
know?
And if it's creative enough, I'm giving you a big-ass bonus because I had
Heck
a lot
yeah.
of fun watching you try to solve that, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah. But I kind of cut Tracy off. You were saying that
I'm
you
sorry.
Hope that the rule set doesn't look like notes.
Notes as in, like, every... We know that this is some friend of the game had this problem at their table, so we're going to include the special rule that makes it go this way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want it to be so hard to remember that I can't just run it at the table. I know lots of tables have no problem with this. I hate having to stop a game to look stuff up. It draws me out every time, and I just want to go home.
Oh, see, that's not allowed at my table. You don't get to stop and look something up. If there's a rules question, I make a ruling, and after the game, if you still think I'm wrong, you can come up to me and then we can look it up. But there's no books and no computers at my table. That's why. It's not because I hate, you know, technology. It's because I don't want somebody to like open up their PDF or, you know, go to the online compendium and be like, well, this says, you know, three turns later. It's like, no, I made a ruling.
Right.
You know, put your phone away, you know.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to be fun. It's not supposed to, you know, and I make mistakes. I'm not, you know, I'm not. And if it's a mistake that causes something that's a devastating thing, then, you know, on occasion I'll retcon it. But usually it's like, okay, well, now we know the rule as it's written, and, you know, and then we move on. And if we run across this again, then we use the actual rule rather than just an on-the-fly ruling. But for the most part, I make on-the-fly rulings because it's, if you hold up the game for something like that, it's like, forget it. You know?
I usually do a mix because a lot of, like I said, most of the questions that come up are my players questioning their own powers. And I'm like going, I have no idea. It's your character. Mm-hmm. So look it up. And I throw them the rules compendium and we move on. But, mm-hmm. you know. But the nice thing about the rules compendium is just that. I mean, it's small and compact, and I don't mind having it at the table to do that. And so most of the time we can resolve things pretty quickly. And at the table where I'm a player, then my DM often asks me to look up stuff because mm-hmm. I have the rules compendium handy in my bag, and I can just look it real quick, and I'm familiar with the rules fairly well. So, you know, it's kind of works either way, but...
See, I treat my players and their PCs I treat my players and how they understand their powers like you treat money, right? Like if they if they forget their little sack of fake money, that means their character doesn't have money, right? Aren't you the one that does that?
I have done that in the past, yes.
Yeah, so the thing is, if my players come to the game and they don't have, you know, they don't have an understanding of how a particular power works, well, you know what? I get to say how it worked then.
Yeah.
And that's it.
And I think that's fair. I don't have any issues with that. No. Yeah.
They're responsible for learning what their powers are because I can't memorize everything. And I don't want everybody to say, oh, I'm going to use this power and then have to read every word on the card, you know, out loud so that we all understand. You know, it just doesn't – it takes the fun away in some part.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, I will caveat that with if it's a brand new player, like I had a new to D&D player who had never played any edition and was playing fourth, you know, we worked with him and he got to, you know, I mean, I gave him a lot of leeway and we could have rules discussions when it wasn't his turn. And, you know, he got to look, you know, sort of learn how to do things. And I let him, you know, do what he needed to do to learn it. But, you know, my players that have been playing since the beginning of fourth edition, you know, you just leveled up. If you forgot to print out your character sheet, hey, then you didn't level up. You know, you can bring the new one next time, or, you know, you retrained and you don't know what the new power does. Well, sorry, mm-hmm. you know.
You were going to say something, Tracy?
Yeah.
I should just close Twitter.
Something that's been happening
a lot to me are the people who give me the most, like, talk to me the most about the whole racist thing are people who, a lot of them don't really play D&D. They like other games better. It's kind of weird to me.
Yeah, I think there is, because there's an opportunity to, and this is particularly true now, I don't think this would even been true 10 years ago. But because of the way media is now, I think because of the opportunity that there's a new version out and that everything you say on Twitter is being seen by someone else.
Right.
There's this idea that, well, even if I don't care, I'm going to contribute because, you know, well, hey, who knows? And so I think it's just an academic exercise for some people.
Right.
And I don't, you know, you could argue the validity of that. I think it kind of clouds the... true discussions that could take place. I think it leads to a lot of tangents that aren't necessarily need to be discussed, because if you're not really invested in it, then, and if you're just doing it for shits and giggles, why don't bother? Don't waste my time. You know?
Right.
So, yeah.
And also, Sarah Barkmagic tweeted, so that was awesome.
Who did?
Sarah Barkmagic?
Yeah. So we,
who's that?
What is that? I don't. Obviously, I don't follow Sarah Barkmagic. So,
I don't know who created it, but I don't know if you know Philomena?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, she accidentally somehow, she was replying to me and changed the D to a B somehow. And so that's how Sarah Barkmagic was created. And no. Somebody created a Twitter account, and every once in a while, like tonight, went ARF!
Yeah.
and it's a picture of a little dog with a wizard's cap. So
nice.
So is this something that you like, or are you offended, or?
You know, I wasn't sure about it at first, but I like it now, and
yeah,
Fred
okay.
loves it. So
it's funny. They haven't been obnoxious with it, have they?
No.
Yeah, okay.
It's not as bad, but it's probably akin to Bill's Gregland.
Bill's Gregland, yeah. I love the Bill's Gregland account. That's mm-hmm. awesome.
So they can have a little more fun with it if they want.
Yeah.
But at first, I using a dog and a girl is just kind of weird. But I was reassured that it was not meant in that way, so I am fine with it. And it's adorable, so.
Yeah. So I guess the new hit celebrity is Dungeon Bastard.
Oh, Dungeon Bastard.
Yeah.
I love Dungeon Bastard.
I was ambivalent at first. Maybe that's not the right word. I was hesitant at first. I did finally listen to the Edition Wars.
Mm-hmm.
I do love that. That is actually a great...
Yeah.
It's like, does it have dungeons? Does it have dragons?
No,
I want to play that game.
Yeah, here's the real Edition War question. Dwarf, is it a race that kicks ass, or is it a class that kicks ass? Answer, who cares?
Yeah, exactly.
It kicks ass.
Right. And I think that's pretty cool. True story, during 8th grade, I wore a headband like that for a long time.
Well,
and it was
Randall,
even a primitive
when you were in 8th grade,
so
it was
poor.
In style.
I was so poor, it wasn't even a terry cloth headband. It was literally a rubber band with a sponge run through it.
Oh, God.
In other words, it was a rubber band that ran through a sponge, and the sponge absorbed the sweat on your forehead. Not even a true headband, a sponge band. Is that a word? Sponge band.
Sponge.
And I wore that. Why? To this day, I don't know why. I did that for like 6 months at school in 8th grade. And yeah, I got a lot of weird looks. Even my teachers asked me, what the hell are you doing? And I don't know. I'm just wearing it. So, you know, it was bizarre. True story, Dead Orcs facts. There you go, folks.
He's going to be at Gen Con, so I'm hoping to meet him.
Oh, is he? Cool. Yeah, that would be great. I want to meet him.
I think he's presenting the Emmys, right?
Yes, he is, as a matter of fact.
So I want to meet him.
Yeah.
I won't say what Geekstream Girl said, but I want to meet him.
Is he single? No. but anyway, yeah, he's been kind of a hit, so.
I like all of them. I mean, sure, sometimes it seems a little jerky. But that's part of the joke. The half elves and the it's just all awesome. I just love listening to it. Doesn't mean I agree with everything, but I love listening to it.
I think I have more professional jealousy that I didn't think of at first.
Yeah, I know.
Because I think I could probably pull off some version of Dungeon Bastard, but I didn't think of it, and I didn't have the production. So it was like, you know, man, go. I have more professional jealousy than anything else. I think the guy's awesome.
Randall, you and I could do Dungeon Bastard. We would just sit on our porch and yell at people to get off our lawn.
Right, exactly. I'd spray people with the hose. Yeah.
I have the dancing on lawn theme. so I don't.
Right, that's right.
I get a saving throw. Mm-hmm.
You do get a saving throw against that. You haven't been. There's been a couple of times I've had to wash Kato off my lawn.
Oh, yeah?
So, yeah, Kato, if you're listening to that, you just watch yourself.
He was just seeking help because he was on fire, Randall. Jeez.
Yes, that's the Kato meme. Always on fire. Yeah, that's true.
That's because they burned the interwebs down.
That's right. Mm-hmm. But
anyway, so we should probably wrap this up because it's been quite a while, actually.
Yeah.
Good talk, though.
I'm just going to say that we're my brother and I, we conferred, and Unicorn is now going to be a class. So.
Unicorn is not going to be a class, huh?
Does it It farts rainbows, and that's its melee attack, huh?
Melee basic. Yeah. Well, and ranged. So
is that a ranged basic? Or the horn has got to be a melee basic.
Got to
right?
Reach three.
Reach three?
But only against touch.
I was going to say, reach three. Wait, what? Is it the size of, like, oh, I don't know, a dragon?
No, the rainbow.
Oh, range three. Okay. Range three, not reach.
No, it's reach.
How's that for rules? Rules lawyering right there. That can't be a reach attack.
That's not as good as the gaze attack.
Yeah, that's true.
Oh, so we're going to live that one down.
Oh, my.
All right.
I just sent you a link.
Okay.
Speaking of unicorns.
And the playable races are going to be humans and pixies. I don't know if I already said that or not.
Oh, I've seen this one. I love the Perry Bible Fellowship. Shout out to the Perry Bible Fellowship. He doesn't post as often. I mean, maybe like once every 6 months, I think now. But
yeah, used to be three times a week.
I know, but it is so awesome and totally warped too. But it's great. So
wait, I see a problem with this. Where are the breasts on the women?
Nah.
Yeah, I don't know. Good question.
Do they lay eggs? I don't know.
Anyway, okay, so I'm going to stop recording, so say goodbye.
Bye.
Good night, everyone.